This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, October 20th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. The Department of Homeland Security is moving rapidly to adopt a new rule that would order the routine collection of biometric data in immigration cases. And that's really just the start of it. Cato's Patrick Eddington and Matthew Feeney wrote separate comments on the proposed rule. We spoke last week. This is sort of an odd situation, and I'll describe it as best I can, but you two have written comments on notices of proposed rulemaking at the federal level, but you wrote separately the issue. So, Pat, why don't you lay out what the proposed rule is and why both of you felt the need to respond to this proposal so quickly?
So, when this was brought to our attention by some folks in the immigration rights community, we realized that we had a relatively short time frame in which to work. And so that's why we made the decision to go ahead and just kind of crank out our own 2 cents worth. If we'd had another week or 10 days, we would have done a single comment together. But this is a particular proposed rule by the Department of Homeland Security for the collection and use of biometrics by the Citizenship and Immigration Service. And the long and the short of it is they want to begin employing a range of biometrics, a much greater range of biometrics on folks than has heretofore been the case. But the most radical thing that I think caught my attention was in the summary for this proposed rule, where it says, and I'm quoting now, first, DHS proposes that any applicant, petitioner, sponsor, beneficiary, or individual filing or associated with an immigration benefit or request, including United States citizens, must appear for biometrics collection without regard to age, unless DHS waives or exempts the biometrics requirement, end quote. So this is totally unprecedented. We've never seen anything like this before, and Matthew will correct me if I'm wrong, but in the past, it's generally been the case that it's just photographs and fingerprints that are required for this kind of thing. And it's usually confined just to the person, in this case, almost always an alien, who is applying for a visa or perhaps legal permanent resident status or something else in that regard. There has never been any kind of requirement for any U.S. person accompanying them or related to them to have to submit for this kind of thing. So that alone got my blood going and convinced me that we needed to do something. And with respect to the scope of this and the technological implications of it, I'll defer to Matthew to talk about that in some detail.
Right. That was a really good outline. It's certainly true that as things stand, people who have been through the immigration system will know that there is some collection of biometrics. And certainly I recall years ago going through my green card process and having to go and get photographed and fingerprinted. But this proposed rule expands not just the number of people who are potentially wrapped up into biometric collection. As Patrick said, this could include American citizens, but it also grows the number of so-called biometric modalities that they can collect. And these include not just fingerprints, but they also discuss in the rule palm prints, signatures, voice prints, iris images, and DNA. And this is a massive expansion, and I think should send chills down the spine of anyone who values civil liberties, and especially not just because this includes immigrants, but also potentially Americans who are sponsoring immigrants or related to immigrants. The DNA, for example, is mentioned in this very long rule, which we had, I think, something like 30 days to put comment together for, as a means to confirm family relationships for people who arrive in the United States. The ostensive concern is that there are people arriving with children and they're saying that they're the parent when in fact they're not. The concern, especially with that, is number one, there are families are made up differently and adoption is a thing, as are step parents. And there are legal documents that already can confirm certain relationships. But basically, this is the kind of, I quoted my comic, what Scalia in his Maryland v. King dissent called the growth of a genetic panopticon, which I think we should be very wary of.
What is the public rationale for doing this?
Well, I want to, well, they say that the point is to, you know, make the immigration system more efficient and secure. So there is certainly a degree of fraud that goes on. But whether this passes a cost-benefit analysis, I'm very, very skeptical of. So, for example, voice prints. There was a mention in the document about using voice prints for authentication, which namely, well, you should just be able to call a government office and it can just recognize your voice, and then that will act as authentication. And that sounds very efficient, and it has been used by other countries, such as the British and the Australians do similar things for tax purposes. But we should also remember this has been used, similar technology has been used by the Chinese in order to help conduct surveillance. So we should keep in mind that a lot of this data, and I think history bears this out, that a lot of data collected for one reason can quickly leak into being used for other reasons. And in this context, surveillance is the most concerning. I would say behind the scenes, I think anyone objectively reading this document has to view it as an attempt to just dissuade immigration to the United States. This is putting burdens on American citizens, not just financially and with their time, but also with their civil liberties.
There is a concern that I've heard expressed before, that when you broaden the range of the collection of data about individuals and you narrow the particular groups to which this kind of collection will be aimed at, you are, in essence, creating a new class. That is, a group of people for whom the government has collected this information and on whom I would think law enforcement priorities might be focused in a way that they are not and cannot be focused on people about whose information the government does not have.
I think that's absolutely fair. And I also think when we talk about this issue of fraud, it could actually work in reverse here. And what I mean by that is, if you stop and think about the kind of data that they want to collect from individual human beings, that data could be used by unscrupulous government employees to commit all manner of identity theft, fraud, et cetera. It could be abused in ways that we can't even begin to understand. So when we talk about voice prints, for example, and some of the other data that we're talking about here, that could absolutely be misused. And it's not like we don't have really concrete evidence of government employees misusing surveillance authorities or the kind of data collection authorities. We go back to the Obama administration when we learned through the work of Senator Chuck Grassley that folks at the National Security Agency were utilizing NSA capabilities to literally spy on their spouses, their former lovers, their current lovers, et cetera. This whole thing got the name of LoveInt, which is a takeoff of Signals Intelligence acronym of SIGINT. And I think that's exactly, you know, what we have to be worried about here in terms of how this could be exploited, especially when we're talking about American citizens here as well.
I would only add that even if you trust the government completely, which is an instinct I urge all people to reconsider, I would note that the kind of data we're discussing, biometric data, has leaked in the past. So even with it's not just we should be worried about what the government might do with this, but we should be worried about the kind of security that that will govern the collection of this data, because there are also criminals and other foreign adversaries we should worry about. Something else I want to just quickly mention is, it's just a pattern that we've seen with Homeland Security, is that these surveillance tools regularly get borrowed by state and local police departments. And we know that DHS has assisted in the surveillance of protesters and other people engaging in First Amendment protected activities. So that's just something I mentioned, because I think anyone considering this kind of rulemaking ought to take a broader context and put it in a historical context.
With respect to how courts have handled this in the past, one of the concerns that I've had, that I think a lot of people have had, especially attorneys who litigate this kind of stuff, is the degree to which it can turn probable cause on its head. That is, you have a database of information, we have a crime that was committed, let's go search the database
to find suspects, which is not how that is supposed to work.
Well, and then also, when you look at what we are now seeing with respect to the entire issue of facial recognition, I'm sure that Matthew can get into even more detail than I can on this. But to the best of my knowledge, just this year alone, we have two confirmed cases now where we've had misidentifications by police in this country of persons of color, men of color, as I recall, on the basis of these algorithms that are used for this kind of stuff. So we get into all kinds of areas here. The thing that also astounded me as I began to kind of really dig into the legislative history on biometrics over the last 20 years is that this proposed rule, at least in my judgment, would be in direct violation of existing law. You know, we only have a couple of laws on the books right now that really kind of govern a lot of what DHS can necessarily do in the area of biometrics. And those statutes are the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004, and then the Implementations of the 9/11 Commission Act of 2007. And if you look at what DHS is proposing to do here, and you look at the two statutes that I've just cited, they appear to be in direct conflict. Now, I'll admit I'm not an attorney. It's entirely possible that I'm misinterpreting the statute here, but as I read the plain text of it, I think they have a problem. Now, that's not to say that there couldn't be a John Yoo wannabe over at DHS's general counsel office who has written a clever opinion saying, no, that's not what those statutes actually intended to do at all. They only really apply to these things, and you know, this is fine. You can go ahead with that. So that's one of the other big concerns that I have with this right now. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, whether other folks have kind of picked up on that as well in their comments.
We should also consider that, as Patrick alluded to, these technologies aren't as accurate as maybe CSI would make a lot of people in the public believe. The issues of racial bias are, I think, pronounced not just in facial recognition, but also with voice recognition. It's important to consider that the false positives and false negatives are not spread equally across demographic groups. And in the context of immigration enforcement, I think that's of particular concern.
Pat Eddington is a research fellow, and Matthew Feeney directs the Project on Emerging Technologies at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.